Welcome to Useful Idiots.
Welcome to Useful Idiots.
I'm Matt Taibbi.
I'm Katie Halper.
How are you doing?
I'm good. You?
I'm good. You know what I saw last night?
What?
I saw Joker.
How was it?
So I feel alienated and incited to violence.
Okay.
Right now.
So it's a norm because it's a weekday.
Because it's a weekday, yeah, for a variety of reasons.
Because you saw Joker, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Where'd you watch it?
I feel disrupted. On a train, yeah.
Joker's on a train. Yeah. Do you like it?
I did like it. In fact, I thought it was really funny because the movie is so much a metaphor for Trumpism and other things like that. And the reviews in like the Washington Post and the New York Times like misunderstood the movie in the same way they misunderstood the Trump phenomenon. So it was pretty interesting.
We should have Leslie Lee on the show. He thinks that's one of the best political movies of late.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely political. It reminded me a lot of movies like Butcher Boy. I don't know if you ever saw that.
No.
Like sort of going crazy movies, but very good. We have a great show. Actor Tim Robbins.
Actor, director.
Actor, writer, playwright. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's going to be terrific.
Yeah.
And we have a lot of stuff to talk about because this is, of course, a hugely consequential week in politics.
That it is, yeah.
And who knows how it's going to turn out. So
I know. Also, we got an announcement.
We do? Merch. Oh, yes. We have new merch.
We got new merch. Just go to, you'll find the links on Twitter, YouTube. It's coming out. Don't worry.
Yeah. We got a lot of excellent suggestions online. A lot of them were either pornographic or drug paraphernalia related. So, we've got enough of those.
Family show. Right. Yeah. Got enough. So send us all your non-pornographic, drug related suggestions for merch.
Well, you can keep sending the drug related.
You just have a lot of competition.
Right.
May not stand
exactly.
Out
it's just going to be a tougher swim up
that
particular stream. All right. Four food groups. What do we have for Democrats
suck? So Democrats suck. We got a Bloomberg moment. This is Michael Bloomberg had something interesting to say about himself and Bernie Sanders. Let's just play it.
Now, I know I'm not the only Jewish candidate running for president.
All right, so I guess this is some Jews for Mike thing, I assume, unless Mike has actually, it would be amazing if Michael Bloomberg actually incorporated
the Jewish star into his
logo.
Yeah.
Because there's an image that says for Mike, and I'm assuming it's Jews for Mike, right?
Right, it's like the Star of David.
Over the I, yeah. I love that because they're two Jewish candidates, Bernie and Mike, and this is like, how out of touch are you when you think that like the bad thing about Israel is the kibbutz system?
Right.
Like, okay, you're the only Jew in the race who wants probably like an apartheid state.
Right.
Like you're the only Jew, Mike, not Bernie. And it's kind of funny because he's kind of actually like Bernie did work on a kibbutz, and a kibbutz, for people who don't know, is a kind of socialist-y
commune.
Yeah, yeah. That Israel used to have. They kind of have them still, but not really. Certainly not the way that they used to. But it's like so out of touch that you're going to use an example of Israel, and that's going to be it. It's not going to be like an ethno-nationalist state or a place where they're second-class citizens. I mean, it makes sense because he's a total hawk who supports anything that the Israeli government does.
Right.
But it's also kind of weird and like sketchy, but I got to say it's also kind of cool because this is a little problematic. So we should have an isn't that problematic thing, but they do kind of represent two different Jewish archetypes.
Do they?
Yes. Yeah. I'm going to Jew explain to you.
Okay.
No, but one of them is like the very wealthy capitalist, who runs the media.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying this is true. I'm saying that is a stereotype that he falls into. So not only is Mike terrible politically, but as a Jew, I don't want him president because we can't take that PR hit.
Right.
It's really not helpful.
Right.
Like buying an election, running the media. No, not good at all. And then
it's both, actually.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then on the other side, you have this Jew who is informed by a tradition of social justice and universalism, and this is a whole interesting episode we get, and socialist and socialist-y.
Right.
And so, of course, that's my Jew.
Right.
That's the Jew that I want to win. That's my Jewry. Yeah.
Yeah.
So in a weird way, he kind of like, without meaning to, laid out the two poles of Jewish identity.
Those are the only two poles? There's none that we're missing?
I mean, there's some, but I feel like those are the two real stereotypes.
Okay.
It's true. Like, those are two of the stereotypes. They happen to be those. And we definitely, not just for political reasons, but for self-interest as a Jew,
would make an excellent ticket in that respect. They would complement each other. No?
Two Jews.
Yeah.
That could be their slogan. Vote Jew.
Two nice Jews.
Two nice Jews. One nice
or
Jew.
Or two
you know what their ticket could be? One mensch, one schmuck. Mensch means human being in Yiddish, I guess, Mensch, but it schmuck, means a good 2020. Person. Oh, you could use the, like, it could be an L. Mensch, schmuck. Could yeah, just actually. Be oi.
Oi.
That could be the motto, right? Yeah. The slogan, yeah. Oi, yeah.
Yeah, you could have the Shepherd Fairey portrait.
Yeah, that would be really good.
Yeah, with somebody looking in the off in the distance.
Yeah.
Oi. Yeah, excellent. All right, so that's Democrats suck.
Yeah.
Republicans suck. Actually, we had kind of a good one this week. It's kind of a classic one.
Yeah.
Wilbur Ross, Commerce Secretary for Donald Trump, his reaction to the coronavirus news, he said that... you know, he doesn't want to take a victory lap over this. But, you know, I don't want to talk about a victory lap over a very unfortunate, very malignant disease. But the fact is, it does give businesses yet another thing to consider when they go through the review of their supply chain. In other words, America could capitalize, but jobs could come back to the United States because of this whole coronavirus thing that's sort of killing people. And
it's amazing. Yeah.
Right.
I like the way he grounds it in history. On top of all the other things, you have SARS, you have the African swine virus there, now you have this. It's another risk factor that people need to take into account. So I think it'll help accelerate the return of jobs in North America.
Right, yeah. China, you will die.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we will thrive.
Right.
And we will Your thrive. Death is our victory. It is a little weird. Like, he could have said, like, not to make light of something or... But I feel like that's such a tell. Like, he really clearly is seeing this as a victory lap appropriate thing.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, usually it's like... I know what he's saying, where, you know, it's like the silver lining. You wouldn't say that, but like an unintended upside of something. It's already gross, but there's something especially gross about the victory lap.
Also, why does he say it publicly? Because you have to, in order to draw attention to it, to plant the idea in people's minds.
Oh, right. Exactly. You know? Yeah, so, totally. Yeah.
So why even say this a thing that you should probably keep to yourself?
Right.
Because it's necessary in order to get into the news so that people like us will talk about it, and perhaps some manufacturer will see the show and decide, hey, you know.
Right. One of our fans will be I'm going to vote for Trump.
Yeah.
Now that I've seen, they're right. We are Trumpian. Matt, you see?
Right,
we are
the exactly.
Left. Just kidding,
it's the horseshoe theory. Yeah,
horseshoe
that's, how
theory,
that's how this all works. So I think that's it's also good because it brings us back to the heritage of Republican suckage, which is, you know, just sort of rapacious,
right.
Instantaneous self interest,
yes.
Right?
Right. So, it's kind of sadistic or at least like indifferent to suffering.
Yeah.
Or actually kind of invested in it.
Right. Invested in it.
And also, I wonder if, I don't think a Bush person would have said this because they had like diplomatic language. I think Trump really has.
I think that this could have worked in the Bush era. Reagan.
Reagan,
I can see this in the Reagan era, you know.
But they would have made it a bit more, like, palatable.
Maybe.
Maybe not.
So what do we have for Isn't That Weird?
So Isn't That Weird, we have a kind of unfortunate story and unfortunate headline, which is man in blackface robs Maryland bank, police say. Police describe the suspect as a white man with paint on his face. So, I mean, it's a little problematic, very problematic. It makes it, I think, kind of awkward to report on. Police described the suspect as a white male with paint on his face who seemed to be in his late 20s to early 30s. They did not specify how much money he may have been able to steal from the bank. But that must be an awkward thing to report on, like as a cop. Do you think anyone was like he was a black man? Do you think anyone like actually fell for the blackface?
Well, you'd have to write a, like what, 1 out of 12 white male with shoe polish on face? Is that what you would say? I mean, you can't say blackmail, right?
No, but I wonder if any of the witnesses, like if they had bad vision there or something, bad
eyesight. So you guys so clearly, he looks like Eminem who fell into a vat of shoe polish, basically.
Yeah, he does.
I mean,
yeah.
It looks ridiculous.
Yeah.
And the hat is even makes it funnier.
Do you think this could be a politician? They always like, you know, this could be like Justin Trudeau.
Oh, right. In other words, they're stopping off from their holiday party, right?
They're
going to rob a bank on the way.
Yeah. Or maybe they were just like, this is going to give me the ability, because apparently so many people who run for politics have some urge to go to a party in blackface.
Is that a thing?
Well, there, how many politicians have been?
Genetic sequencing thing?
Oh, maybe. I don't know.
Right.
But we have a lot of scandals where they do that, right?
That's
Didn't
true.
One make that up? Didn't the guy running for sheriff?
Yeah,
or like,
that was,
he
was
didn't
one of
make
our
it up,
stories.
He admitted it, right?
Yeah,
he offered it. Like, there wasn't even photographic evidence.
Right. I think he was maybe trying to curry favor.
Yeah, exactly. He was trying to get voters. So,
Isn't that terrible? It's kind of an easy one.
I know.
The coronavirus thing is a classic like news scare phenomenon. I mean, it's a real thing. People really have to be pay attention to it. But the modern news business is designed to instantly freak out about this and project every conceivable fear and anxiety angle that they can about this. And the story has already gotten to the point, the saturation of it, you're already seeing the ripples back, which I thought was interesting. The Steven Soderbergh movie Contagion is now like in the top 10.
Wow, yeah.
So people are already, they're going back and they're watching basically crappy virus movies because they want to get into the spirit of being scared to death about...
It's like merch.
Right.
It's almost like, it's like disease merch.
Outbreak is going to be next. Yeah. People are going to go buy old copies of The Hot Zone. And there's a lot of, there's been a lot of stuff. So they've already had all kinds of disasters about this, that, and clearly this is going to get worse. We had a cruise ship that was stranded with 6,000 passengers and 1,000 crew members were blocked from disembarking a Costa cruise ship that was near Rome because there was a woman on board who was feverish, who was from Hong Kong. So this kind of stuff is going to start happening, and people are completely freaking out about it. And some people are already making like memes to themselves on the internet. Like there's you know, spoofs of Simon and Garfunkel songs.
Hello, virus from Wuhan. Another problem's here again. Because you see the contagion creeping, and the virus is indeed spreading.
So people are completely wigging out about this. And, you know, there was already, what, one case in Seattle, right? So there, once this gets to the U.S., there's going to be full-blown panic. Because this is every family's worst nightmare is, you know, some disease that's unstoppable is going to reach, you know, the suburbs, basically.
Yeah.
And so the instant there's one of those cases that hits some kind of non-urban area, the story's going to take
it. And if grunge music and Starbucks are any indication.
Right. Things that start in Seattle, they spread.
Really?
What do we got to talk about this week? We got to talk about politics, right?
Politics, of course. Should we start with Biden or Warren?
Well, let's just start with the big picture. The way things are looking now, I mean, this is shaping up to be kind of a historic moment in sort of the annals of the modern Democratic Party, because Bernie has separated himself in the polls. And even some of the other candidates are starting to talk about reduced expectations. Warren sent a notice, or at least I think it was internally, there was a notice to followers. The expectation is he's going to win there. And there's the polls are separating themselves also in New Hampshire. And, you know, this hasn't happened in the Democratic Party since, what, 72, where there's somebody the party abjectly does not want.
Right.
Is becoming a threat to the nomination. And I think there's going to be just pandemonium once this happens.
Like, it's a good thing you saw the Joker, because it gives you a little
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, preview, yeah.
Get all the Bernie folks in clown masks turning cars over.
No, it'll be the Biden folks in clown masks.
Oh, no, no, yeah, yeah, deal.
The Biden folks and the Warren folks. Hey, it'll be Biden and Warren themselves. Can you imagine it? what would happen is, like, Biden would be like, Liz, come on, Liz, calm down. It's always the quiet ones.
Right.
So Biden would maybe do as a fun way, but then like Liz Warren could actually get really upset, I feel like, and actually start doing Joker stuff.
She's
and Joe Biden would be like, calm down, Liz, come here, for God bless you, Liz. He'd like bring her in a bear hug, right?
So when they do the autopsies of this week, they're going to look back and think about the insanity of what happened. If Biden turns out to be the last best hope to save the modern Democratic Party, I mean, what an amazing metaphor for how fucking screwed up this party was. This was the champion here, like literally senile person.
You mean if Bernie doesn't win?
If Bernie does win, they're going to look back and they're going to blame these other candidates who dropped the ball.
I got it. Yeah.
For driving the party off the cliff. And the fact that at the very end, like the last ditch holdout to save the new Democrats.
Because
essentially this is a species of Democrat that was invented in the late 80s. You know, after Mondale lost, they kind of reinvented the party and created this new version of the Democrats that were no longer as dependent on unions for financing. They were pro-business.
Right.
They triangulated, you know, they took more conservative positions, and they thought that was the electoral formula that's going to save us forever. Right. And it's just run out of gas.
Yeah.
Like, that whole thing is run out of gas literally this week.
It's rot. Yeah.
Right. And the last, you know, sort of exemplar of that species clinging to a hope of the nomination really is Biden, I guess,
right,
or Buttigieg. I don't know. It was amazing this week. he had an amazing moment of vulnerability on the trail.
Joby?
Yeah.
How come no one calls him that? Joby? Joby, we should call him.
Joby?
Yeah, I like it. It's cute.
Can we take a listen to Biden musing about his potential time in office?
So this is him talking about what would be necessary for a vice president.
Well, for me, it has to be demonstrated that whoever I pick is two things. One, is capable of needing to be a president because I'm an old guy. Okay? No, but I'm serious. Look, I'm thank God I'm in great health. I work out. No, I'm serious. I work out every morning. I'm in good shape. Knock on wood, as my mother would say.
There's a
lot
here.
What did he say there?
Knock on wood, as my mother would say.
Yeah.
And he taps and he you know, knocks on his own head. I like this. You know what I really like about this is that, first of all, it's a reminder of when he said, listen, fat.
Right.
Because he's really prides himself on his health.
Remember,
right?
Yeah, and you talked about the push-ups.
Yeah, push-ups, yeah. How he's not sedentary. But right. What I love about this is, as usual, Biden actually speaks a lot of truth.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of appreciate that he owns his age in this sense. But what's really great is he's saying, like, so there are a couple things that I would need to pick someone for vice president, for running mate. One is they'd have to be able to be president. Now, of course, this is a guy who was vice president. So the suggestion implicitly is not every vice president is capable of being president.
Yeah.
Right. He's like, this would be one of those vice presidents who would have to be. And it's kind of interesting. Yeah.
In this unusual case.
Yeah, exactly.
You should probably pick a vice president who is capable of being president.
Right. And if we accept that, I do think we can accept that kind of subconscious confession of his own inability to be president, or at least he's, I think at the very least, he's kind of hinting that Obama did not pick him to be president, right?
Right.
Like, he didn't pick him as like a good person to replace him. He picked him to make him more electable.
Well yes. And so the story that behind that is that they picked Biden, you know, precisely because they were concerned about reaching a certain kind of Democrat,
right,
who was uncomfortable with picking
an African American,
right? Exactly.
President. Yeah.
And so, you know, I talked to some people this week in D.C. I was down in D.C. and one person who's sort of tangentially related to the Democratic Party, like, they were saying, Biden is a guy who shouldn't be allowed to drive, much less run for president.
Yeah.
But they're all like hoping nonetheless that he's going to be the guy, you know,
really?
Which is
the same people who wouldn't give him a driver's license.
Right. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Right.
The thing is, Biden, I could imagine him in a total state of dementia lifting weights. Like, the issue isn't his physical strength. Right. The issue is that he'll be like joking around and.
Yeah, the issue is that his brain is completely, I mean, he's like mercifully free of the ravages of sanity at this point.
Right, yeah.
I mean, it's a thing that people are commenting on who cover him, that he just kind of wanders off. Like, he's frequently, it's not clear that he knows exactly where he is. And yeah.
Wanders off the reservation, as ironically, John King, I remember him saying that once when he was covering Biden. It was like a special that CNN did on his gaffes.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, they were like, well, he does tend to wander off the reservation. And they weren't even using a pun. They just,
right,
you know, of course, I'm sure that was very painful for Elizabeth Warren to hear.
Yeah, for Warren. Meanwhile, speaking of Warren, she did a little mini Liz Holyo this week when she learned that she won the endorsement of the Des Moines Register.
Right.
Do we have that clip?
Yeah, I can see that is a bit of a mouthful for sure.
Oh my God. Okay, that's kind of cute.
It's cute. Yeah.
So Warren, who's she talking to? She's talking to someone and she's bent over and she's in like a half holio. What would you call that? Maybe we should.
It's like a stagger holio because she doesn't go like this.
Oh no, but I would say it starts earlier. So you see her, she has her arm around someone and I think that's almost a half holio. Because you could see that as a, no, right there.
Before, oh, I see.
So before she moves her arms in a,
oh,
see, if
yeah.
you look at it as a bent over holio. Look, watch me, ready? So this is the Liz Holyo. She has her hands up, like hands in the air, elbows bent. But this is like she's it's flipped over.
Uh-huh.
It's like pre-holio.
That's true,
You can see it as, basically, she's just rotating at the elbows.
It's like an earlier species of
exactly.
Like an Australopithecus.
Before we were totally upright.
Yeah.
She could have been dragging the knuckles.
Yeah, that's the Zinjanthropus version
Liz Holyo. So she does that. So she has her arm.
Liz Holyo.
Yeah. So she has her hand on someone's back. She's like bent over to hear what she says in half holio pose. And then the woman says something. And then she's like, I did? And obviously she says she won. And then she does this, like, It's almost like, remember when we saw Steyer doing the whoop with his fist, Arsenio Hall thing? She's almost doing that. She just starts punching up in the air and like her hands are in
a thumbs up. She does a dance. It's a good dance.
Yeah, it's a good dance. Yeah. It's cute. I like it. Yeah, and she goes, I did. And she puts her hands on her chest in a...
Right. It's not going to help though. And this is interesting because... So last time Trump got something like 2 endorsements to Hillary's 90, whatever it was. It's some ridiculous number. We can look it up. Endorsements don't matter anymore.
Right.
I mean, they're just not important. And I think it's another example of how this whole system has broken down. Like it used to be such a huge deal.
Right. She should be upset, actually, between this and the time. She's done.
Yeah, she should respond with some kind of like mournful indifference, maybe. It might have been.
Yeah. Or a Holio, like a sad Holio dance.
Sad Holio.
What would that be?
I don't know.
That would be like totally on the ground.
And she, which often happens with candidates who are in a semi-desperate situation heading into a week before a vote, they will come out with a crazy proposal.
Yeah.
Not a crazy proposal, but a loud proposal.
Right.
And so she came out. So the headline, which is somewhat misleading in CNBC, says Elizabeth Warren proposes criminal penalties for spreading voting disinformation online. That's more right. There was one that just said spreading disinformation.
Right.
The proposal that she came up with, she's proposing holding tech companies that do not change, that specifically don't change wrong information about where you should go vote, that you should be held to a criminal penalty for failing to fix that. Mm-hmm. But there's also a whole lot of stuff in her proposal about creating a new body that would examine the whole question of divisiveness and misinformation, and would consider sanctions, additional sanctions for disinformation mm-hmm. online. And she's been kind of doing a little bit of this all year, and this whole thing drives me crazy. I don't know how you feel about
it. Because, overreach, like
This whole complete rethink of how we police bad speech.
Then
the way that they're looking at this so casually, like we spent hundreds of years getting to the point where we had this system of how we deal with things like libel and and now they just want to do away with it. And the problem here is that the people who are going to be deciding what is and is not misinformation, there's going to be both the tech company and the government above it.
Right.
And so once you get the government into the business of deciding what is and isn't true, it opens this huge can of worms that like we've specifically tried to avoid for hundreds of years in this country.
I do like her quote where she says she wants to make big structural changes to the tech sector to promote more competition. I wish he would just make big structural Bailey.
Right.
This is going to sound very problematic, but I kind of think if it was only limited to like literal information about, I don't think it should be criminal, but what if it does seem like it's a good idea to have the correct voting addresses, locations?
Absolutely.
But is it possible to do it in a way that's...
You could do that in a way where you... Well, first, the thing that I don't like about this is they want to create a separate body, and then they want to give the penalty to the platform and not to the person who does it.
Right.
So what's going to end up happening there is the platform is just going to wipe out anything that's even close. It's not even that. That's the
principle of
you could make that a species of election fraud or something like that without.
Without
messing
right.
with
yeah,
speech.
Yeah, yeah. Got it.
What she's talking about, her whole proposal is it talks about divisiveness and foreign interference and all
so
these.
So it stirs it's like almost like the coronavirus of politics. It's like this fear and hysteria about how the Russians threw the election to Trump last time by sharing Buff Bernie memes.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's probably already against the law to misadvertise, a polling site or something like that. And especially if you have something to do with another campaign and you do it, that's got to be, I would imagine, against the law. But what they're talking about is getting the government in the business of forcing these companies to be really, really aggressive about deciding what is and isn't true, which is something they were never doing before 2016. And now they want to go all the way in this other direction. And we've already seen how that's already had a huge impact because they're already like taking all
cracking
kinds of things off the internet.
Right. Including videos like about the things that they are bad. So like videos educating people about white nationalism,
right,
white supremacy, all that stuff. Like, I don't know what I call them. Yeah. About
or things that are very debatable, like the name of the whistleblower, right. Like, you know, I can't say it because right. YouTube will take it off,
right.
So I like I don't know,
I anyway. Like how stupid this article is though, because it says other candidates such as Klobuchar and Sanders have also been skeptical of large technology companies. Sanders has repeatedly targeted Amazon, saying it should increase its wages and benefits for workers. Like, that's a very different,
it's a completely
action,
different,
you know,
animal,
being like
yeah.
advocating, like putting political pressure on an oligarch to raise wages is not creating a new law
exactly.
to penalize, to make it a crime.
To, or yeah. to, worse than that, to, or to use their enormous monopolistic power to police speech or whatever
right,
it
yeah,
is.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's
but,
funny that they don't get it. Yeah,
and Warren has, to be fair, I think she's also talked about the fact that they don't pay a lot of taxes. And things, you know,
sure,
so,
yeah. But that's a different type of targeting.
Right.
You know, yeah.
So Iowa, I mean, what's your prediction?
Well, Bernie, of course, unless something really bad happens. I also kind of am impressed that Biden wasn't like, and this, you just made me think of this with the prediction. I'm impressed he wasn't like, look, I could bleed out any day. I could have an eye bleed out. So maybe that'll happen. Remember he was bleeding?
Yeah. What's the name of that condition?
I can imagine in the cold, he just busts another capillary in the eye or something.
It would be funny if it were like the movie Scanners, where if he was giving a speech the day before, you know, the caucus,
yes.
and his head just
yeah.
exploded.
Well, that's going to happen to the press corps.
Can we see
when,
a Scanners explosion?
Sanders wins, yeah. So great. So his head just blows up, yeah.
I like the sort of orgasmic expression
yeah,
on
so
Michael
gross.
Ironside's
really,
face.
That's the most disturbing part. Yeah. Forget the like the bleeding head. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, his face is disgusting. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's fantastic. All right. So most stoned, we had a few. What do you want to start with?
Bloomberg.
All right. So Bloomberg did a great one. I think this is going to live forever. This
yeah.
is going to go straight to towards the top of the list.
Where's my ice cream? Ah, thank you. Hmm. Big gay ice cream is the best.
What is that?
Are we allowed to speculate on what metaphorically it means when you take a big bite of big gay ice cream?
I mean,
cream?
I don't even, it's, you don't even need to. It's just there. It's like so there. But what is this big gay ice cream?
I have no idea.
It is just a brand of ice cream.
Oh, it's an actual brand. Oh, okay. Well, then that's actually, unfortunately, less funny.
No, nah, I don't know. Either way, I think it counts. Yeah.
Yeah? In that case, I'm all right. We should eat some gay.
We should.
Yeah.
Why don't we get them to sponsor us?
Yeah, we should do that.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll eat some next week.
Yeah.
And then what else we have? We have more Joe Biden Instagram stories. I mean, this feature. Oh, first of all, is that two bong gravity bongs way up or way down on
oh,
that one? Is that stoned or not?
It's definitely stoned. It's
you
like
think?
It's munchies.
All right. So
it's big gay munchies.
I'm gonna give that to gravity bongs way up.
Yeah. Okay. What's this now? We got Biden.
Hey guys, I'm here with my pop. We just wrapped up outside and we're having a great time,
I'm
right?
To.
Oh my gosh, this is so embarrassing.
Who's it?
Oh, sorry.
Well, I'll tell you what, this is a real pop, man. I tell you, you gotta talk to me, not a cardboard cutout.
What's the joke? She's standing next to a cardboard, like a cutout? And she's embarrassed? Like, is the idea that she couldn't tell the difference between her actual grandfather and between Joe
right?
Biden and a cutout?
I'm gonna say this is a couple of dime bags way down on this. I don't think this is a terribly
well again
moment.
the threshold is so high for Biden.
That's true.
So no, this is just Biden being Biden. Biden's
yeah, and
Biden.
It's you know it's his granddaughter. If it were just some random person who was volunteering, it would be different.
Who he kisses on the head? I don't know. It kind of would be more Biden. Either way, yeah, it's not that stoned.
It's a little weird. Yeah. But but the other one, the Mike
yeah.
Bloomberg, I think that's that one's gonna live in
forever. Yeah. So Bloomberg, in addition to eating big gay ice cream, also made a cute commercial.
Yeah.
With
dogs for Mike.
Thinking. Dogs for yeah. If you are yeah.
Mike Bloomberg is the man to lead us.
He will create more jobs.
Mike's not afraid of the NRA, not one bit.
Trust me, Mike will get it done, yeah.
Get it done, yes.
He does not tweet. Oh.
I like Mike.
I like Mike. I lick Mike.
I'm Mike Bloomberg's dog. I approve this message.
I'm Mike Bloomberg, and I approve this message.
This is maybe like the best ad I've seen all season. It's
so I totally disagree.
Sorry, I'm such a dog person. I'm such a sucker that he just got my vote, basically.
I'm anti-talking animal.
Oh, no, film. I love those things. Really? So, yeah, this is, yeah. So the animals are lip-syncing.
It's a cute cheat.
Dog's
I hate it.
Fur, Mike, F-U-R. I didn't realize that. Dog's fur,
terrible.
Mike.
Terrible, terrible.
And his own dog's in it.
Yeah, I'm gonna go thumbs down on this one.
And this is after, of course, he famously, or not famously, but interestingly enough, shook a dog's head, basically, instead of shaking its paw.
Yeah, he grabbed a dog by its snout. I love that word, snout.
It is a good word. It's a great
word in like almost every language, too. There's like a word for snout in like lots of different...
What is in Russian?
Morda. Morda. Great word. And actually, what they say in Russian is like, if you hit somebody in the face, like, you dealt to be a pomorde, it's like... I bashed you in the snout.
Nice.
Yeah. Okay. Here's Mike Bloomberg shaking a dog's face.
It's abuse.
It's not.
It's abuse.
It isn't. Dogs
it is.
Dig that.
Oh my God, you're victim blaming.
No,
you're
not.
You're saying it shouldn't have worn that collar.
Dogs think that shit is funny.
I don't know.
They do.
It does. He's shaking his head from the... How do you know? You're like a dog.
I have a dog. I've had dogs my whole life.
Okay, obviously Matt has engaged in this behavior, this abusive... He's a dog shaker. Have you done that to your dog?
I have done that to my dog.
God.
And then my dog will knock me down.
Okay, that's fair, I guess, if it's strong enough.
It's not horseplay, it's dog play.
Oh, look at you. That's a regular old Katie Helper pun.
That tells me that this is a person who's spent a lot of time around dogs.
Right.
Maybe not always appropriately, but, you know, it's a dog person.
Almost like he's going to lift him up through his mouth.
No, he's not. He's not afraid to stick his hand in the dog's jaws.
And you
which
need
is
that
awesome.
For a president.
Yeah, and first of all, a dog will. If you're not a dog person, a dog will let you do that.
All right, they'll chomp.
It'll bite your hand.
You, yeah.
So I don't know. I'm all for that. It is weird though. How do we vote on that? Is that
it's
stone
up to
or
you.
Not?
I'll give you the. I'll follow your lead on that. It seems to be a very normal daily occurrence. So I guess
I'm gonna vote. Yeah, that's the bong way up on that. Yeah.
All right. Cool. Yeah. Anyway, so without any further ado.
Let's introduce our guest,
Tim Robbins,
who
we spoke to last week.
Let's talk to Tim Robbins. Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming on the show.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Tim Robbins.
Tim Robbins, yeah. We just so you know, Matt, we met a while ago because I went to his play Embedded, which was really good, and about media embedding, basically.
You were taking credit for a movie actually coming into being.
Yeah, I did. So I helped midwife then to being because I went to his play Embedded.
Uh-huh.
At Joe's Theater. Was it?
Public Theater.
At the Public Theater at Joe's Pub, sorry.
Yeah.
My dad raises his hand, and my mom, I'm with my mom and dad and family friend. My dad raises his hand, and my mom and I are like, don't ask too many questions. And he's like... My questions are, and then one of them, the second one, was like, this is so great. Can you turn into a movie? And you're like, well, we would love to, but we don't really have, the funds and blah, blah, blah. And then I was working at that time at DCTV, which is this great
That's
organization,
right.
downtown community television. And we did much more kind of like affordable and high-end affordable shoots.
Mm-hmm.
So we did it, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
And it wound up being one of the first pieces that Netflix picked up.
Wow.
Oh, yeah.
Way back in the day.
Yeah.
Wow, that must have been a lot, because they've picked up a few since then.
Yeah, one or two. And it was really good. It's about the Iraq War coverage by the media, and there were masks, and there was like the Condi role. You had all the different like neocons.
The Office of Special Plans. You remember them?
Yeah. I was embedded.
Leo Strauss devotees. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
It was really good.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, great. So you have history.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you have a new thing coming out, right?
Your new.
Should we make a movie about this too?
Oh,
the new Colossus?
I'm going to be shooting some of the audience's reflections on it.
Right. Okay.
It's called The New Colossus. Mm-hmm. It's 12 actors speaking 12 different languages, telling...
So it's in 12 different languages?
Yes.
All real? Are they all real languages?
Yeah.
Okay. I didn't know if it was something.
For a lot of the actors, it's their first language. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's from 12 different time periods, from 1868 to 2017.
Okay.
And it's about the journey from a very dangerous environment to freedom. And it's I asked all of my actors to research their own stories, their family's stories, and to write it down. And I helped them put it together. And it's a quite moving piece because it at the end of the piece, after this long journey and the challenges that they have to overcome, they get to a place where they can plead to get on a boat. And they all plead to get on the boat. And then we ask the audience, should we let them in?
Wow.
So the audience has to decide.
Wow.
So that's an unusual process. So you wrote it, but is it inspired by the actors talking to their families about their experiences? Was it like a collaborative thing?
Oh, yeah, for sure. A lot of them had to talk to their families, and their families didn't want to talk about it.
Oh, that's interesting.
And so they had to overcome these obstacles and actually wound up creating much deeper bonds with their mothers and grandparents.
So it's like an oral history also, too.
Yes, yes.
That's great.
And so at the end of the play, I ask the audience, I come out and ask the audience, where are you from?
Right.
First of all, are there anybody that's descended from indigenous people?
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of hands come up. What nation? Yeah, Iroquois?
Yeah.
Wow. Anybody that was...
Was Elizabeth Warren in the audience?
I knew that was the instant you went there.
Sorry. Yeah.
Anyone descended from people that were brought here against their will? African Americans' hands come up. Do you know where from? What year?
Right.
No. Yeah. Don't know. One of our original sins, that we eliminated entire culture and the memory of that culture.
Mm-hmm.
Then I ask any refugees in the audience, some hands come up, where from, what year? Immigrants, where from, what year? Okay, sons or daughters of immigrants or refugees, more hands come up. Grandsons, granddaughters of immigrants or refugees, more hands come up. Great-grandsons, etc., until everybody's hand comes up.
Right.
And you have people from all over the world every night in Los Angeles. In the lobby, we have a map, and we ask people to put magnetic pins on where they come from. Every night in our little theater in Los Angeles, the entire world is represented.
Yeah.
Like every continent except Antarctica. Not a lot of immigrants or refugees from Antarctica.
There's still time. Maybe
And then I ask them to share stories, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's when it just becomes just sublime, because people are, you know, the play has made them think about, my own story. And we hear stories like, you know, I want to tell you about my grandmother. She came here to America when she was 8 years old on her own, on a boat. With a photograph of a relative. That's it. No address, nothing. And lands in New York Harbor and finds her family.
Wow.
This is an audience member?
Yeah, an audience member telling her about her grandmother. Another woman says, I want to tell you a story about an American soldier. He was part of a troop that was liberating Buchenwald.
Wow.
And he saw this woman, and she was faltering. She's starting to fall. She's starving to death. And this private starts running towards her, and the sergeant says, stand down, soldier. We're not doing that. He disobeys. He gets to her, catches her before she falls, carries the woman to the field hospital, gets in trouble from the sergeant, goes to visit this woman after he gets out of trouble. And this woman says, that's my mother and my father.
Wow.
These stories are out there.
So they got married, that couple. Yeah.
Yeah. And so we hear this. We hear testimony.
And you're videotaping it?
Well, hopefully on the road. Yeah, we don't videotape because we want the audience to be able to share.
And feel comfortable.
But then afterwards, we're going to invite them to come on the stage, and if they want to share, they can share.
Yeah.
But every night we get deeply inspired, and the audience itself realizes, wow, you know, we have so much in common. Here's what we have in common. We have this incredible DNA, whatever that is. You know, okay. So first of all, we are all descended from people that said no. No, I will not tolerate famine. No, I will not tolerate religious oppression. No, I will not tolerate fascism. And I will risk my life to get away from it. And then they have the strength and the resilience to survive that journey. And then they have the strength and resilience to survive the journey over water. And some died. So we're not descended from that DNA. Then get there to this new country with nothing and somehow create a future. And that future is sitting in our audience. That's what's incredible about this collective experience, is that it's something that binds us. And in these times when we're finding so many ways to divide us, there's so many people writing so many horrible things about so many different people, including, you know, online, all whatever.
Yeah.
Here's a way we can understand, you know what, you might disagree politically, but you have something in common. You share this hero's journey, which is really what it is. You talk about the people that are leaving oppression in Central and America and Mexico, and they're traveling 500 miles on foot for the chance of getting over the border, for the chance of creating a better life for their children.
Yeah.
Think about that, in that strength that must take to survive that journey and you know, to create a future. That's, in my mind, that's Greek myth. That's the hero's journey. That's the way we should be talking about
it. And then surviving, if you were from here, surviving colonization is also like a miracle,
yes,
or heroic, or and also like against all odds, right? It's an anomaly because of the disease and the killing.
Yes.
And then surviving, you know, coming over as an enslaved person.
And surviving all the, you know, the terrible rhetoric that's thrown around about your wave of immigration, whether you're Irish in the late 1800s or...
Where's your family from?
My family's on one of the first boats.
It's a safe space.
My grandfather did the research many years ago and found John Robbins, 1660 Massachusetts.
1660, wow.
Yeah.
Where in Massachusetts?
I think it's, I don't remember. It's at Amherst, some small town. He found the grave.
Wow.
And yeah.
Wow. So you were talking about the divisiveness. Was that the inspiration for it? Was it the Trump Muslim ban? Was it, I mean, obviously.
No, we started during the Obama years, during the Syrian crisis.
Okay.
And we were just talking as a theater company, and we were like, this is wrong, completely wrong. They're trying to say, oh, these are potential terrorists. Right. No, these are mothers and children that are leaving violence and in a refugee camp. You know, who wants to do that?
Right.
You know,
yeah.
Like no one wants to leave their home.
Right.
So as a response to that rhetoric, we started talking about who we are and what our stories are.
At the Actors Gang.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Okay. So that was the genesis of this. And so it's been a while now that this has been in the works.
Yeah. Huh? Yeah.
Okay. And is this the first play that you've written? I know you wrote a couple of movies, right? You wrote Dead Men Walking, Bob Roberts.
Yeah, I've written about four or five plays over the course of years.
Harlequin
Freedom.
That was great. I saw that in L.A.
Yeah. Which was really cool when we were in China doing Shanghai. You know, if you remember at the end of the play, the character of Arlecchino says, I don't want to do this play anymore. It starts going off on this rant. And someone from the state comes in and says, what's going on? You know, get back to the play. And so he starts back into the play and he can't control himself. He goes off again. And the person from the state comes in and arrests him, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we're doing this in China. And I'm like, are you sure you've read this play? Are you sure it's okay? They said, no, go ahead. And so at the moment when he's taken off, there's a big silence in the audience, right? And then the person from the state says, all right, continue the play. And so they start trying to do the play. And then one actress puts up her hands and says, no, and walks off the stage. The entire audience in Shanghai erupts in applause.
Wow.
It was a moment like, wow.
Right.
That's theater, you know, they're allowing them to express solidarity with rebellion.
Right.
And then the next actress puts up their hands, applause, you know? So it's touring theater is such a gift at this point, because here we have an opportunity to sit with a group of people who are never going to be that same group of people again, specific chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
And we get to meet them and figure out what that chemistry is and tell that story to them. And then they get the opportunity. And by the way, one of the last places on earth you can ask people to turn their cell phones off, and they will. They can sit with you for an hour and a half in a meditative silence or in a shared emotion and be able to experience humanity through this. It's an extraordinary opportunity.
Is it hard once you've started doing movies to stay in touch with theater? I mean, I know it's a tension that a lot of actors have, or is it a luxury that you have to make time to do it? How do you see it?
From the very start, I made time for it.
Okay.
From the time when I was working in episodics, I would tell my agent, listen, 4 months, I'm not going to go to any auditions. And they thought I was crazy, but I was learning how to be an actor. I was learning how to be a writer, director. And I always viewed it as a way to stay sane in Los Angeles. To keep going back to the laboratories, keep going, testing yourself, the humility that it involves to do a play, you know, because you can't fake it, you know.
Right.
The audience is going to tell you whether it's good or bad.
Right.
And in movies, you can get in this kind of zone where, you know, you never hear that, you know, you never hear any reaction. You just like everyone, your publicist says, you're fantastic.
Yeah, you're doing great. Yeah.
And, you know, I've seen how that can lead to, you know, a decline in your chops.
Plus, you can do a million takes. You don't have to you don't have to get into it as much, right? I mean, you can study the night before.
Which is not to say that there aren't some, you know, brilliant actors out there that are working that way, and some just uncomfortable with doing theater. But it's always been a lifeline for me.
So art in itself is obviously socially beneficial. It's an important thing. Is there a tension between activism and being an artist? In other words, do you think there's a moment at which being an activist can detract from the art? Do people know that you're involved in political causes? I know you've had issues with this, right? Like the Baseball Hall of Fame didn't like the fact that you were involved with, you know, opposing the Iraq War. Is there a thing that you have to think about with that?
Well, I think essentially the way I looked at it was, if I don't say anything, I'm going to really dislike myself.
Right.
It was about compromise for me. It was like, if I don't say anything, I might get a better part or get richer or anything. And it's just about your own compromise, but it's also who you're drawn to and who is drawn to you. Mm-hmm. And because I have lived that way, I've been able to meet some of the most amazing people.
Sister Helen Prejean,
Harry Belafonte, Nelson Mandela, you know, who I could sit in a room with and have lunch with and share experience with, because I think that I didn't give a shit.
Right.
There's other stuff, and wanted to use my voice in whatever way I could to help.
Can we talk about Dark Waters?
Sure.
That's like, speaking of activism and art, it seems like a great example of the intersection of both of those things. And your character in that is really interesting, because it's kind of the moral side of capitalism. So I guess a reformed, restrained capitalism, where I heard you on an interview how there should be like a bottom. You said something about a moral bottom line.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that character and why you were drawn to it?
Well, when I read the script, I the first question I had is this character real? Because it's a guy who's a managing partner in a conservative law firm in Cincinnati who represent chemical companies.
Right.
And they, against lawsuits, you know, against them, right? For, you know. And so I was like, this guy can't exist. And then I realized, yeah, it's true. What he did was true. He allowed one of his new managing partners to take on a lawsuit suing DuPont,
right?
A company that normally they would have represented against lawsuits.
Right.
And so he did it because he saw those videotapes of the dead livestock on this guy's property. And he said, that's wrong.
Yeah,
it's very simple for him. It was, there's a right and there's a wrong, and if corporations are going to be allowed to do this, it's bad for everybody.
Yeah,
if a corporation is allowed to pollute and violates any kind of environmental regulations, then the companies that are following those rules are being screwed, because they're going to have to pay the cost of this malfeasance of DuPont.
Right,
and so this Mark Ruffalo plays this real life person named Rob Bellotte, who is a modern day hero in my opinion, who had to go through 12 years of this lawsuit with many different machinations of discrediting and trying to kill the lawsuit, trying to buy people off.
Yeah.
And, you know, he prevailed, but still is fighting now, is suing DuPont and other chemical companies on behalf of every single person in the United States, because now these PFOAs are in 99% of our bloodstream.
PFOAs, explain.
Teflon, which was the product the magic pen, wound up poisoning 99% of the people in this country.
It's a great scene in the movie where he's trying to figure out what that stands for.
Yeah.
Mark Ruffalo's character. Yeah. And, he's talking to a chemist.
Yeah.
But the scene where your character, it's Tom Terp is the name, right?
Yeah.
Where he goes off into this amazing soliloquy in front of the other partners. And I had the same reaction you did. I thought, is that real? Because there isn't really, except for the part that he allows Bellotte to pursue the suit, there's not really a hint that that's in that character until that moment. Is that hard to do? In other words, like the other scenes, how do you play the character in the other scenes to make that, to sell that scene as more believable?
Well, I talked to Tom. I had some Skype calls with him, and I wanted to know all the details. I wanted to know how much he was supportive of all that. And it was in the script. And so he's allowing this guy to do it, but it is hurting the law firm.
Right.
And he does have a bottom line. And, you know, they do have to pay their bills. So it's that practical thing where you're like, I'm for this morally, but, you know, can I support it for 12 years?
Right.
And so he had a struggle, but he supported him the whole way. And, you know, I want to tell that story because maybe that story will inspire other Tom Terps in other corporate boardrooms to know what their moral bottom line is and say, you know what, we can't do that. We have to draw the line somewhere, you know?
Yeah, because it's so interesting because it was almost like, until that moment, it felt a little bit like it was kind of a stock character, right? Like the boss, the corporate boss, who's not really in tune with the morality of the character, but he makes this amazing turn in the middle of the movie. I just thought that was really and unusual too, right?
Yeah.
And what's happening now with that? The EPA is trying to.
Yeah, they just. So I think that what they want to do is they want to get rid of any water regulations or about polluting in water, so that it's going to be okay to dump water in streams and in protected areas. And it's my opinion, it's sociopathic.
Yeah,
I think we should just start talking about it that way.
Yeah.
I mean, what kind of person is making billions of dollars and still wants to, like, hey, you know what? Screw that stream. Yeah. Screw the water system. Because here's the thing. Poison water doesn't care whether you're a Democrat or Republican. It's going to make you sick.
Yeah.
And it's something that we should be all united against, this kind of corporate malfeasance. And this administration's just going, you know, hey, let's just go for it. Let's go for everything. Right. Let's take all the rules away, you know?
Yeah.
You supported Nader in 2000, and I know you get this question a lot, but there was so much blowback in 2016 against people who supported Jill Stein. Do you find it amazing that now people like yourself, Cornel West, who supported Nader, if I'm not mistaken, in 2000, now you're with the Bernie campaign. The nomination is actually a real possibility. Are you amazed at the journey that the party has made just in, you know, 5 or 6
you
election
cycles? You mean that
cycles?
Someone could be someone like
exactly.
who you would support is actually now viable?
Right.
Yeah, it's still difficult. I mean, they don't make it easy.
Right.
But listen, the reason why I'm supporting Bernie is because I believe this in 2016, I believe he can beat him. I believe he can beat Trump. Yeah. I've seen it on the ground. I see the broad coalition he has. I see he's got 1 million volunteers ready to knock on doors. None of the other candidates has that. Wouldn't you want to go with the most popular senator in the Senate?
Right.
I mean, to what do you attribute that the parties so they have such an obvious reluctance to embrace that idea?
I don't know. I don't know. There's many answers to that. I'm just looking at the positive. I see how he can build coalitions, and I believe he has the best chance to beat him.
What was it like not being a Clinton supporter in Hollywood?
I don't really travel in that crowd.
Right, but I mean more like in terms of job, like not that you hang out there, but when you're a working actor, let's say, like, did you fear some blowback, or did you fear that people would not want to work with you? I mean, I know it's not like the McCarthy era and you were a communist, but it does seem like that was such a...
Yeah, I try not to think about that because that's that, you know, oh, I didn't get the job because of that. You know, oftentimes I don't get jobs because I'm 6'5".
Right.
You know, it's like, just face it. You know, there's certain actors don't want to work with you.
Right. But does it feel weird? Like,
is that really a thing?
Yeah, sure it is.
Oh, don't want to work with you because they don't want to seem short sometimes?
Well, you know, it's difficult to line the shot up, you know?
Yeah, like, right.
One movie that wasn't a problem was Bull Durham, right? I've always wanted to ask this question. I apologize. Did you model your wind-up after any particular picture? I felt there was a little Fernando in there.
You got it.
Juan Marichal, maybe, a little bit?
A little bit, but mostly Valenzuela.
Okay, all right, excellent. Yeah. Did you play baseball?
I did. Huge fan, yeah.
All right.
And also, the behavior kind of, what was his name? Bill Lee, do you remember him?
Oh, yeah.
The crazy.
Yeah, from Boston, so.
Yeah. What was the other one? Jimmy Pearsall.
Mm-hmm.
You know, baseball players that had this crazy, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, they were crazy. Also,
Bill Lee was really crazy.
Yeah. I also love Jim Bouton. You know, the seminal book in my teenage years was Ball 4. You know, I was like, wow.
Yeah, every kid tried to throw a knuckleball after that book came out.
I actually met him. And,
really?
And he taught me how to throw a knuckleball.
Can you throw a knuckler?
You know.
You think that's something people are born with? Like, I
no,
feel like you can't.
You have to be a little twisted, I think, to throw a knuckleball.
Yeah.
Because you're throwing it so slow and it's going. Whoop, whoop, whoop.
I don't even know. What's knuckleballer?
You throw a pitch with no spin on it and the air makes it move like in all directions.
That's cool.
It's kind of like a cartoon. You know, if you imagine a cartoon, a ball coming in and goes, yeah,
it's impossible to hit when they throw it right. Was that what's the most fun movie? I mean, that had to be one of them, right? I mean,
live a childhood fantasy, you know,
right?
Putting on a baseball uniform, pretending to be a baseball player. Absolutely, yeah, that was a big fantasy come true.
How was Bob Roberts? What made you decide to write that and be that character?
I started it as a short for Saturday Night Live.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and originally he was a. You know, because I just moved back to New York to do a movie. It was 85 or something like that. And I had been away from where I grew up in Greenwich Village for about 6-7 years. And in that time, it had kind of gotten gentrified.
Yeah.
And so all the old Italian cookie places were now David's Cookies. And, you know, I was, what the hell is this, right? So I wrote it originally as a yuppie folk singer who was in Greenwich Village. And then as I kept working on the script, Bob's ambition grew and he became a candidate for Senate. And so it took me about 5 years to put that movie together. And I was able to do it right after I worked with Robert Altman in The Player. So I was really primed. I kind of used The Player as my film school, how to direct. Mm-hmm. And got Gore Vidal to be in it, which was a great treat because he was able to bring his perspective on American politics into that film. And imagine a successful businessman running for a political office who happens to be a big fan of beauty pageants.
Yeah,
you know?
Right. Yeah.
Who would have thunk it?
And pretends to be care about normal people, ordinary people.
Yeah.
As a con artist, yeah. What's it like as someone who wrote and was in and directed Embedded, what's it like to see these people who were selling the Iraq War be like main faces on MSNBC?
Well, yeah, that's troubling. I mean, you certainly don't get any medals or rewards for being right in this country. You know, in fact, you saw so many people get it wrong.
Right.
Who got bonuses and,
right.
and you know, career advancement out of that. They're still on the air.
Right.
Still saying what they, you know, are paid to say, I guess. Yeah, it's disappointing, but I think here's the good thing. I think it's more and more obvious to more and more people because there are more means of communication and because people can spread information in a different way. You can spread information without the permission of the mainstream media.
Right.
It's kind of liberated information in a lot of ways. And that's the positive. And I prefer to look at it that way, that, you know, more and more people will understand that a certain faction is trying to propagandize for a war. And I think you've seen in the last 3-4 years, it doesn't work the way it used to work. It's not as quick. It's not as not a home run. There's more doubt. There's more questions being asked. People are going, wait, you're trying that one again?
Mm.
And I don't know if that would have been possible without the invention of some of these new means of delivering information. And in a way, that might be keeping us from that next catastrophic war. So I have a hope about that kind of thing.
I mean, in a lot of ways, the success of the Sanders campaign really reflects that you just don't need the assent of traditional media anymore. You can bring your message lots of other ways, right?
Yes, we'll see.
We'll see.
I think one of the big challenges this year is, you know, there's how many people that don't vote in this country?
Yeah.
100 million or something crazy like that?
Yeah.
And maybe if all of us just took it on our own to say, you know what, I'm going to try to find 5 people that don't vote.
Unlikely voters,
Try to get them into the ballot box.
Yeah.
You know, that would shift things.
Yeah.
That's a positive way to do it.
Right.
I mean, I don't know how much we really achieve by yelling at each other.
Yeah.
I don't know that you can change anyone's mind doing it that way. With the new Colossus, when we're going out, we're looking to build bonds. We're looking to find ways to be on the same page, to understand the common experience we have.
And in the new Colossus, is that are people going to be able to see that in other cities? Are you going to go on? What's the schedule?
Well, we start in North Carolina on January 28th. To February 2nd, if you don't mind, I'll just tell the dates that we have. We're in Schenectady, New York at Proctor's Theaters February 7th and 8th. Detroit, Michigan at the Music Hall February 14th and 16th through the 16th. Seattle, Washington, Moore Theater February 20th, 22nd. Durango, Colorado Community Concert Hall, February 25th, 26th, Iowa City, Iowa, Hancher Auditorium, February 29th, Folsom, California Stage 1, March 3rd and 4th, and Nashville, Tennessee, James K. Polk Theater, April 9th through 11th.
Nice. Excellent.
Yeah.
Excellent.
So we'll see a broad cross section of the country. And I'm really looking forward to it. I'm going out for the whole tour, and I can't wait to have these conversations, hear the audience's stories, and find some common ground out there.
Sounds like it could be a great documentary at the end, right?
Where, I think so.
Yeah, it could be a cool thing.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. We wish you luck. Is there anything else that you're going to be working on down the line? What's the next big project after this?
Don't have it right now. I've written something. I always try to write, and with the hopes that there might be some crazy rich person out there that give me a lot of money to do the next Bob Roberts. But I've written a satire about a rampant id that is out of control.
That's an interesting, because I feel like we've lived through a little bit of that lately.
It might have something to do with that.
Yeah, yeah. Excellent. What can you tell us a little bit more about the rampant id?
It's like that thing, you don't want to jinx it by putting it out there, but let's just say it's about what happens when the rampant id meets ultimate power.
That's a really funny idea.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Tim Robbins. Really appreciate it. Thanks for coming on Useful Idiots, and good luck with Colossus.
Me. Thanks a lot.
And where can people find info about it? Is there a website? Or
TheActorsGang.com.
ActorsGang.com. Great.
Thanks.
Take care.
I learned a lot today.
Mm-hmm. Super interesting interview. Interesting that he seems like he goes against the grain a little bit in terms of how actors deal with their projects.
Yes.
And so that's interesting. And he's not afraid to talk about politics, which is cool. So,
what else? Well, you're going to be going into another state
soon. Yeah, I'm off to Iowa probably tomorrow at the end of this week. So I'm going to be there over the weekend, and I'll return right before we cut the next show. So it's going to be interesting. I'll try to get some Bailey film, and talk to some folks while we're out there. If there are any Useful Idiots fans in Des Moines or in the surrounding towns,
do the Useful Idiots Pod hashtag.
Useful Idiots Pod hashtag if you're going to be around in the area.
And trail you? You're going to say hi to them?
Well,
if
you're going to go to an event, let me know, hashtag me, and maybe I'll see. I can seek you out in the crowd. We'll just do some interviews.
Forget the candidates. Just
exactly. Who needs them? All right, so we'll have lots to talk about next week, and we'll see you then.
Great. Thanks. Bye.
Mike Carruthers shares little pieces of intel and interviews you can use to improve your life on the Something You Should Know podcast.
The next time you're looking for a job and have to write a cover letter, here's some advice from Skip Freeman, author of a book called Headhunter's Hiring Secrets. Add a P.S. to the bottom of that cover letter. That can actually increase the chances of that letter being read by up to 75%. Some people actually glance down and read the P.S. first.
Something You Should Know. Search on YouTube or wherever you listen.